Can you start by telling us about yourself and your experiences with prison and prisoner support?
Sure. My name is Daniel McGowan, and I'm a former political prisoner. I've done 7 years in prison for actions I took with the Earth Liberation Front, or the EOS, in the late 90s, early 2000s. My experience with prisoner support is, for most of my activist life, I've been involved in prisoner support, and then I found myself, being on the receiving end of a tremendous amount of support and solidarity from friends and comrades on the outside.
Can you speak to the importance of prisoner support as part of the Anarchist Project and other liberatory struggles, and specifically to the necessity of supporting long-term prisoners?
Sure. Well, I think prisoner support is really something that's needed for anyone that goes to prison. Unfortunately, the networks that exist are largely built around our comrades or people that we know in prison. I think long term is sort of a thing that means different things to different people. I tend to think that a person that has a 2-year sentence feels like it's long term. So it's sort of a relative term, but I would say obviously the longer the sentence, the more solidarity and support that's needed. I think any movement that takes itself, seriously, anarchist or otherwise, needs to provide for the consequences of state repression or interactions between, our movement and the right wing, in terms of interactions or incidents between, Antifa and right wing fascists. I think without having that safety net, not only are people less inclined to take action, to feel that they're part of a movement, but they realize that, it almost feels like a martyr situation where people are willing to, confront state power or fascists, and then there's literally no one to help them or work with them while they're in prison. I think as a person is in prison longer, the needs often change, and I think that prison degrades and harms individuals, and so I think the longer you're in, the more it's necessary. And understanding that most people that, statistically most people that go to prison come out, we also obviously have situations where we have, people with intense cases, political cases that are potentially, they have life sentences or they have technically access to parole, but it's meaningless because they get rejected all the time. And so I think the needs of long-term prisoners are slightly different than short-term, and a short-term prisoner might have their eye on their outgate, and so they don't want to basically catch a new case or catch more time. And I think we've seen situations like with Jared Chase, where his release date, Jay Chase from the NATO 3, his release date has been pushed back. So he's already supposed to be out of prison, but unfortunately, due to interactions with the cops inside, his sentence has been extended to, I believe, 2019, which is obviously problematic in a lot of ways.
What forms of solidarity were most important to you while you were in prison, and what could have been done better or different?
Well, I think having, I think having access to people that I can call and email when they finally, instituted email was really important. I liked the fact that I knew that I had a crew of people that I could rely on, that when I was, bundled up and put in transit, that I knew that people were looking where I was, that they would reflect on the fact that they didn't hear from me and they would be looking out for me. I liked feeling that there were these people, my family, my friends, even people I didn't know, around the country and the world, that were willing to make a phone call, to email the BOP or bother them, to have lawyers that were willing to, come and visit me while I was in transit. I remember there was this one time I was at Oklahoma City, and my partner at the time got me, I found out later, paid a lawyer to come in and visit me just to get me out of the segregation unit, and just to kind of, for me to, let the lawyer know kind of what was going on. And that lawyer was able to relay it to my kind of long-term lawyers and let them know. So knowing that, people gave a crap about me, that I had an outlet, I had friends that I could ask for things that made my time a little easier, and that people were willing to to basically pressure those in power to, like, on my behalf. You know, that was really affirming and supportive. As far as how things could have been done different, I think we learned the hard way that, like, because my communications were monitored, it was really hard for me to, like, sometimes make specific requests. And so, of course, people want to do right by you, so they don't want to do anything that's going to put you in harm's way. But I remember, for instance, when I first got to the CNU, I remember thinking, like, how awesome it would be to like, for people to have, like, a support demo outside, and how, like, how that would have probably flustered the Bureau of Prisons and been like, this dude's from New York, and yet somehow he's able to mobilize people to be in the parking lot, you know, banging on pots and pans and making noise and kind of, you know, that's not exactly something the prison gets a lot of, the way they cite them in the Midwest and often in rural areas. But I always thought, like, that would be something I would love, but it was, like, pretty much impossible for me to ask. So, like, my phone calls, even my legal visits were all monitored on some level. You know, they're not obviously supposed to monitor legal visits, but I think it's imperative that people with, you know, cases that are scary to the prisons understand that the more than likely their cases are going to be squatted on, and their phone calls and their legal visits are potentially going to be recorded. So it's kind of like we just realized along the way, like, oh, okay, so there's basically going to be a whole bunch of things that we can't communicate to me and that I can't communicate to them.
Can you speak more about your time in the CMUs and other tactics that the state used to try to silence and isolate you?
Sure. Well, I was in the communication management unit at both prisons, both communication management units or CMUs. I was at the Marion one for 26 months. I got moved into general population at Marion, and then the government concocted some fake reason to throw me back in the CMU, and so I spent the remaining 21 months of my sentence at Terre Haute, Indiana. I think a lot of what it had to do with was I was put there because I was in a sort of vulnerable position. I was I had a terrorism case. I had a violent case, which, you know, they consider arson violent, and it came with what they call a public safety factor for what they consider a greatest severity offense. So it's the kind of case that has a lot of highlighting and asterisks on my file. And so it was easy. I'm not a Muslim, and I have a terrorism case. And so when they opened up the second CMU at Marion, they kind of put a few people in there that could, you know, basically they can point you to say, oh, no, you know, it's not a Muslim unit, you know. They put myself and Andrew Stepanian from the Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty case. They had sovereign citizens, which are, you know, of all different races and nationalities. They put an old neo-Nazi from the Order, a group that kind of engaged in targeting people as well as armored car robberies. So they put a few of us in there as sort of their, like, you know, their proof that these units, these CMUs, were not just, you know, Muslim terrorist units. I also think I was doing academic work with a university in the Midwest, Antioch University. I was writing a lot on sociology, or I was doing a sociology degree, so I was writing a lot about my case. I think they found those documents, and they saw the amount of mail I was getting, and essentially when the place that I was at, Sandstone, was asked for, you know, sort of nominations, it was pretty easy for them to send me there because I'm vulnerable because of my case. So I was at a low-security prison, but it was very easy for them to put me there. I think part of it was I wasn't breaking any of their so-called rules, but I was writing a lot of political stuff. I was writing about the drug war for, you know, fellow people in prison that I met, as well as, you know, just how basically fraudulent and bogus prison is and what prison does to people. I met a ton of people when I was at Sandstone that were there for basically crossing the border, had 5 to 7 year sentences. I met a bunch of people who were being put away crazy 30, 40 year life sentences from meth. It just kind of opened up my eyes to a whole other element of the prison world. So I wrote a lot, and I put it online through my, you know, my friends and family. And so, you know, I think they were unable to give me incident reports. They weren't able to kind of stick me with that. So they just put me in this place where I think they thought I would just, you know, roll over and kind of do quiet time. It didn't really work that way. I sort of, you know, I felt like I was doing quiet time, and then I got sent to the CMU, and that really kind of lit a fire in me again. And I decided, you know, I was just going to kind of war with them over the next, you know, 5 years, which is, you know, pretty much what I did. the other thing they did in terms of isolating me and silencing me was that, you know, there's particular aspects about the CMU were pretty onerous in terms of communication. So they did things like limit the, you know, the communication and CMUs to, and when I first got there, one phone call a week, which you had to, like, sign in, like, a week in advance, and you can only call one person. They made the visitation so bad, it was, like, 4 hours a month. So it was really kind of hard for me to, like, ask people to come, you know, 2,000 miles or whatever, 10,000 miles to essentially come for, like, this horrible non-contact visit. They monitored all the communications. I think they had people in the unit that were rats that were willing to help the government out. And they did an immense amount of rejections of my mail. So my mail going out was monitored, obviously, and recorded and all that. But really, my mail coming in, if it was political, they really were very broad in their use of rejections. I got something like 100 magazines and newsletters rejected over the time that I was in prison. I pretty much did, you know, grievances for all of them, which was just my way of kind of being a bit of an asshole and a stubborn bastard. I just basically grieved every single time that they rejected anything from the, you know, the prison level up until D.C., which, you know, it's crazy. It takes like 9 months, and then at that point you're allowed to sue. I obviously didn't sue on any of my magazine rejections, but I basically pissed them off. You know, I wasn't able to get Earth First Journal or Rolling Thunder or a lot of the magazines that's to this day really don't even publish anymore.
A topic that has come up for us a number of times is continuing support for people as they're released from prison. How was your transition, and what was helpful for you, and what would you want other people to know about post-release support?
It's interesting. I think the release thing is getting a lot more attention these days from our community, you know, because I think we're getting better. We have a lot more people go to prison, a lot more people come out of, you know, back into the movement, and we're sort of learning the hard way how rough, you know, reentry is. Most of the programs that exist for reentry, many of them don't really work so well for politicized individuals for a lot of different reasons. For instance, so maybe people come out and they already have good housing, but they don't have, you know, maybe they even have a college degree or something like that. Maybe they even have job prospects. But usually people are coming out of prison with some struggle, you know, and sometimes it's everything. It's housing, it's legal difficulties, it's stay-away orders from felons or co-defendants. My situation was such that I was, at the time, married. I had a place I could go to live, and I got halfway house time. I got 6 months in the halfway house. I also had a crew of people that were really amazing in their, like, dedication and fundraising. And so when I got out, I had a couple thousand dollars, actually more than a couple thousand, to really, you know, buy some clothes, to buy a computer, buy shoes, things that, you know, it had been six years. So I needed to replace some things. And so I was really good on that level. Like, I was like, oh, I have my material needs met. I was at the halfway house, came home on the weekend, you know, we'd order takeout food because I wasn't really allowed to leave. I also, you know, did very well. Like, I was remanded back into custody for writing an article basically about the CMU, and I had lawyers, so they were able to get me out of prison the next day, which was really amazing. But I struggled, you know, sort of psychologically with, you know, they say you leave prison, but prison doesn't leave you. And when I first came home, I just had a lot going on and had a hard time. I was at the halfway house, and it was kind of hard for me to really, they wouldn't let me see like a shrink, like a social worker. And I had some contacts from the movement that were willing to, like, you know, help me get some access to mental health care. The halfway house, which is, you know, essentially like a contractor of the government, would not accommodate that. And so essentially what happened is I had, you know, a lot of two steps forward, one step back. And then I had a bit of a crisis based on some stuff that went down in my personal life. And at that point, it was kind of essential that I see someone. And essentially a friend of a friend who is a social worker offered, because I wasn't actually even able to go to her office, basically came down and met me every week in, like, a coffee shop near my job on my lunch hour, which is, you know, I mean, that's the kind of thing that not everyone has access to, and I felt really supported and spoiled by the whole thing. And then when I was able to get out of the halfway house, I, you know, I saw this person, you know, in a professional capacity for, like, 3-4 years. So, yeah, my problem was more, like, just feeling lots of anxiety, having a hard time with crowds, And that's the sort of stuff that everyone's struggle when they leave prison is going to be different. I used to tell myself, oh, you did 6 years, you know, and I was living with men that did, you know, 30, 40 years of life. I thought, you know, I was going to get out. Everything was going to be, you know, peachy keen and fine. And I got out and it was, you know, it was really tough. I got out and I felt like I was still in. I was very sensitive to, you know, any kind of offense, like everything like hurt my feelings. And I, you know, I wanted to fight all the time. I mean, I sort of stayed out of trouble, but inside my head, I was just like rolling emotions. And so I think when people come out, we need to reach them, you know, hit them where they're at. Some people are going to get out and they're going to have amazingly hard times with every aspect. You know, if they've been in a long time, they might be like, I've never seen a smartphone. I've never seen a computer. I taught computers in CMU and I dealt with men that had pretty much never even seen a computer or used the internet. So it was really kind of challenging. You know, my situation, I was in this for 6 years. So like I had, you know, I'd never seen an iPhone, but I certainly understood what a phone was and how to use it. So my ability to like get back into things was good on that level. But everyone's going to have different situations. You know, in New York in the last year, there was a political prisoner that was in for 37 years. His name is Maliki Shakur, and he came home and he was just, you know, he took like a fish to water. With phones. I mean, he's good on the smartphone. He texts, he sends photos, he knows how to use it. And he's, you know, his housing situation was aided. But, you know, I mean, I can't imagine he has a lot of great job prospects, having been out of the job market or whatever society for 37 years. Then you have people, you know, I know you're familiar with Zolo Azania, who gets out and has like a crew in the Midwest that have been helping him. So, you know, everyone's going to have a different time, you know, a different struggle. I think we need to, I don't know if we really need to have an organization, but I sort of try to help people when they get out. I try to help their support crews in thinking through, you know, some of these issues around housing, legal support, health care, especially for older folks, mental health care, all that kind of stuff. I think it's something that we're just starting to really deal with like, you know, I know there was a wave of people that had shorter, you know, sentences. The Tinley Park Five and Jason Hammond and people from the NATO 3 case, they all got out, my co-defendants, myself, a ton of us got out after serving anywhere between 2 and 7 years. And we all, you know, are out there in the world as felons, like trying to get some work, trying to deal with like, you know, the issues that, you know, work presents when you're a felon. So I think we just have to reach people where we're at. We have to start sharing more information. The people that are out, that are off probation, that are felons, need to talk to each other more and kind of prepare for when we know people are getting out to help them, you know, materially, but also just as a, you know, just as like a sounding board. Like I talk to people when they get out, if they're able to, you know, talk to me and just try to hear them out and then see, you know, see them through the tough times.
How has serving years in prison changed your perspectives and your practices around prisoner solidarity?
Well, like I said, I did a lot of prisoner support before I went to prison. I would say maybe, you know, like something like 8 years. I started doing prisoner support in the late 90s. I done prisoner support for Rod Coronado and a number of other animal rights and eco people. I did a lot of support for Jeff Lures. One thing, probably the main thing, is that I realized that charity-based prisoner support that is sort of like a group doing stuff on behalf of people on the inside, I think can be really problematic. I think regardless of whatever people on the outside think, people that are doing time know what prison is like and are better able to decide like how they need to do their time. I know a lot of times you have political prisoners or people, political cases or politicized individuals. They're very vocal. They're very, you know, they decide to buck, you know, so to speak. They do kind of hard time. They're like bucking with the administration. And that's definitely one way to do time. It's, you know, sort of the way I did my time. I wouldn't say I was too, you know, I mean, I kind of felt like what I was doing was really minor, but the way the government responded to it was so insane. But everyone has to do their time the way they need to. And I think that when groups on the outside put expectations onto people, I think that's problematic. I have some good co-defendants that, you know, they reported to prison. They kept their head down and they did their time. And I think, you know, at the same time that we understand that people need to do their time the way they need to, we also need to recognize that, like, part of the reason they use things like the CMU or the Special Management Unit or Supermaxes is to scare people.
And so I think we do need, you know, people that are willing to struggle in prison and not just, you know, put their head down. I think, like, I'm cool with the way my co-defendants did their time. A lot of them were, you know, kind of just kept their head down and their eye on the clock and you know, were trying to, like, you know, perhaps lessen the craziness, the impact on their family. But I also thought, like, in my situation, I felt like I was faced with a kind of intolerable situation, and I thought, you know, who better to you know, fight back than myself? I mean, I'm in prison. I'm someone that doesn't want to, like, look askance when there's horrible stuff going on. So I felt like I was in the right position. So I think, like, the model of working with prisoners, not for them, getting rid of that charity mindset, I think a lot of that is happening with work that people do on the prison labor front. I think understanding that it's a mutualistic relationship, I think a lot of old-time prisoners, long-term PPs or whatnot, have a lot to offer. I think I've had some really interesting relationships with people in prison, both when I was in prison and when I got, you know, before I was in, where I was able to learn from and influence people, and it's mutualistic. I definitely, you know, I do support for prisoners, but they're certainly not limited to the anarchist movement. And I feel like my rapport with, you know, older leftists is, you know, it's very good, and it's not sectarian, and there's no belief that I support everything they think. I'm definitely not interested in, you know, the tenets of Marxism or state building. But, you know, I engage people where, you know, on things that we have in common. So I think, like, getting away from the charity mindset, working with prisoners, helping them get their voice out there when they can't do it themselves. But always understanding it in the context of mutual aid and solidarity and not in the context of, you know, this poor person. I mean, for the most part, I'm sure, you know, there's a lot of innocent people in prison, whatever that means, innocent. But we got to also recognize that our comrades had agency, and they made choices, and we are supporting them through the consequences of that stuff and the repression. But we don't have to think about people as victims.
So you mentioned that you were doing prisoner solidarity both before and after UNM. Do you want to tell us more about some of the prisoners that you're actively supporting?
So I got politicized sort of through this organization that was kind of run out of the basement of a bar in New York City called Wetlands. And they used to have these monthly or weekly meetings, actually. And so a large part of, you know, the first meeting I went to, I think it was like an animal rights thing. And there was someone there speaking on behalf or selling zines or for Rod Coronado. I got very involved in writing him, and I did support for people from this Santa Cruz 2 case and a bunch of different environmental saboteurs or animal rights prisoners. And I thought, you know, that was definitely my politics at the time, you know, limited to just that. And so I had really interesting interactions with people. I live in Eugene, and I was friends with Jeff Lurie's Free. And so when Jeff, I was sort of part of his support committee, but when he got sentenced to 22 years, 8 months, I had actually written a bunch of longtime political prisoners and kind of like almost out of desperation and asked them for help. And I realize now I kind of laugh at myself for like having the nerve to write all these prisoners and ask them for help when they're doing all this time. But I got a lot of really great answers from people like Marilyn Buck and, God, I think it was Leonard Peltier. But there was a bunch of people that were just willing to give me some advice on that. And so, you know, being exposed to that out of a need, I started paying more attention to the sort of political prisoner world. And so, yeah, I had been involved for a while, you know, doing stuff kind of related to like anarchist Black Cross kind of political prisoner support. Since I've gone and out, I've mostly been focused on two different things, which is like support for long-term New York State political prisoners, and then also mostly younger and newer cases from sort of the anarchist movement. So I help out a little bit on the Cleveland 4 and 803 case. I've sort of made myself available to kind of talk through issues with you know, legal issues that people are dealing with, helping people get lawyers. So I try to help people get lawyers for different situations. I also have been heavily involved in trying to get some of the long-term Black Panthers in New York out. It's like Herman Bell and Jaleel Musa King, Robert Seth Hayes, and also not a Black Panther, but a long-term New York person, David Gilbert. So I write most of those individuals, and I work with them on, like, basically trying to raise their profile and fight back attempts from the Policemen's Benevolent Associations, basically the pig union, and the Fraternal Order of Police, who are very actively campaigning against the Black Panthers that are going up. So I try to do a little mix of both. I think, you know, my ideas about prisoner support are rooted in that we have to definitely support our comrades that we struggle with, that we fight with. I think it's disingenuous to be part of a movement that, you know, if your movement is effective, you are definitely coming into contact with law enforcement. And so to not see through that situation where you have comrades, you know, that are getting popped for various things, I think is kind of fraudulent. I think it's just cheerleading if we're not willing to support our comrades. And so that's sort of my mindset for why, you know, I do political prisoner support for, you know, Cleveland or NATO 3 or Eric King, people like that. And like I said, the rest of my time I mostly spend on working on the long-term New York political prisoners, but I tend to be one of these people that find myself drawn into different campaigns if friends are asking for help. So
you've been doing this for a long time. What are your hopes and visions for prisoner solidarity in the years to come, and how can June 11th as a project fit into that?
It's a tough question. I mean, I think June 11th is a great thing. I think, you know, I'm not sure if people know, but I was sort of involved in the beginnings of June 11th back in 2004. June 11th is obviously, maybe not obviously, but it's the day that Jeff Lurz was sentenced to 22 years, 8 months in, I believe it was 2001. And he got that for basically burning 3 pickup trucks at Giromini's Chevrolet. And so we decided, and, you know, there was actually a very spirited rally and march, and cops got a little crazy in 2003. People in Eugene, you know, sort of pulled off this act. And, but in 2004, we kind of decided we wanted to do a worldwide thing. So we did this International Day of Solidarity in Action for Jeff Lurz, and the FBI sort of aided our efforts by releasing what they called an eco-terrorist bulletin. And so all the different events around the world, there were 57 of them, all the different events around the world, at least domestically, were sort of messed with by the FBI. I mean, there was like a tremendous amount of law enforcement attention paid to an event, like a film screening in Worcester, Massachusetts. And I was actually in New York at the time, and we went around basically ticketing like SUVs, you know, with these fake tickets. And Eugene, they had a bunch of very large events. And so we did it in 2004, we did it in 2005, and then I got indicted, and the people that were part of Jeff's crew kind of extended it to, you know, the Day of Action for Eco-Prisoners. And so I think it's a good thing, and I think that things change, and you know, Days of Action or whatever, they morph, I understand, you know, going from the Eco-Prisoners to Marius and Eric, and now Marius and long-term anarchist prisoners. I think these sort of days are good in terms of, like, rallying support. It's sort of reminding everyone that we have people, you know, inside. I hope that there's, like, material gains that could be made for people in terms of, like, raising funds and raising awareness. So, yeah, I think, you know, but from my own, like, personal perspective, like, I think it's important for anarchists to not just do some political prisoner or prisoner support for anarchists. I think that there's a broader world out there, and that when we limit ourselves to just the people that share our ideology or our identity, we're really limiting ourselves in some ways from the mutualistic work, as well as like lessons we can learn from elders that are inside. I think also when we are doing work that's like limited to anarchist prisoners, but then we're asking other people to care about anarchist prisoners, it seems a little empty if we're not engaging in some sort of mutualistic, you know, prisoner solidarity with other movements. I know that's probably not something that many people want to hear, but I do think that when we focus on just anarchist prisoners, invariably we end up focusing on a lot of white people too, which when we're considering like the racial identities or racial makeup of the prison system in the United States, it is largely a black and brown and red thing. And I just think we need to be addressing in our work, obviously, the white supremacist culture that we are in.
That said, I think, you know, June 11th is something to support, and I think it's like a good opportunity to rally support for the people, anarchist prisoners. And I think it should continue. In terms of like my hopes for prison and solidarity movements or whatnot, I think we have a situation in the next couple of years where we have an opportunity to sort of get a lot of the old timers out on parole, or whatever, release, compassionate release. I think we have sort of a limited, time to do so. I think like campaigns that are not specifically focused on political prisoners, but sort of are focused on the prison system as a whole are important. I think not only on their own accord, but I think that those kind of campaigns could end up actually helping the political prisoners, whether they're the old timers or the new folks. You know, I'm thinking about groups like RAP, Release Aging People and Prisoners, in prison, excuse me. That's sort of a group that exists in New York and a few other places. And they're sort of addressing the fact that people have been put in prison for just insane sentences, these 25 to life sentences. And they're kind of beating back this idea that this punishment idea that, you know, America has in terms of if someone does something wrong, according to the system, they have to be punished. And it's this like lifelong thing. So I think groups like RAP and others have done, has actually had, done more to change the narratives around prison, than sometimes the somewhat narrow focus of the political prisoner groups. So I hope in the next 5 years we get a significant amount of the old timers out. And I think that, there's a lot to, we have a lot to do in terms of the current, like, anarchist prisoners. I find, like, you know, from my understanding, a lot of them do not have access to adequate funds. And they're sort of like, I know in situations with like Jared Chase, it's been very difficult to maneuver, through the complexity of having someone that is suffering from a terminal illness that affects his cognition and his judgment at the same time that he's being kept in the SHU in the segregation that is rapidly contributing to that situation. So I think the anarchist movement can really gain a lot and get a lot better at supporting its prisoners. But I, you know, that said, I think June 11th could be part of that, and I think it should, so.
Are there any other projects you're involved with or things you have interest in that you'd like to share with us?
Yeah, sure. I'll just tell you about one project I work on. It's this calendar, called Certain Days, Freedom for Political Prisoners. We are currently, accepting submissions into June 7th, from people that are incarcerated. It is a calendar that is in its 17th year. It exists sort of as an educational thing about prison and prisoners, but also exists as a fundraiser. So last year we raised a bunch of money. We gave it away to different groups like that group I mentioned, RAP, a group called Adamir, which works with Palestinian prisoners, and a group called the Unist'ot'en Camp, which is an indigenous homestead in Canada. Made up of the Unist'ot'en people that are basically resistant development in their territory. And so people can check out, you know, we're right between calendars right now. We're working on the 2018 calendar. But if you check out certaindays.org online, you can find it on Facebook and Twitter too. You can see like our call for submissions as well as just like bookmark it for later because our calendars come out in like August. We also usually get organizations to sponsor, prisoner calendars. The prisoner calendars are a lot cheaper, and so groups will give us like $100, and you can just send prisoners' names, and we'll send them, you know, essentially free of charge to prisoners. So that's pretty much what's got my attention right now. Like I said, I've been working on supporting a number of different anarchist prisoners in like a support capacity, trying to help them get their, you know, just increase their capacity to raise money and, you know, get books and get birthday cards and stuff to make their days a little more passable, support them in whatever they're working on.